guilty verdicts are evaporated, as Ted Stevens' lawyer said, just like as if they never happened.
Ted Stevens walks away from his long legal ordeal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 7th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Begich defends the federal stimulus package in a speech to state lawmakers.
We've got to put some money on the table. That's what we're doing. Do I like it? Not necessarily. Is it necessary? I believe it is.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Former Senator Ted Stevens' conviction on charges of concealing gifts has been thrown out, and the indictment against him dismissed. The judge who oversaw his trial last fall is ordering a criminal investigation into prosecutors who bungled the case. Alaska's former senator made few comments as he left the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C., where he was convicted of lying on financial disclosure forms last fall. He was accompanied out of the courthouse this morning by his wife and three daughters, as well as friends and former Senate staffers. Stevens swept past most microphones, but had a simple message for Alaskans.
Now, tell them all I'm going to enjoy this wonderful day, that's all.
Stevens said if he was his enthusiastic former colleague, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, he would say hallelujah. Then he got into a van with his family and lawyers and left. APRN's Libby Casey covered the Stevens trial and was in the courtroom this morning. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, what was it like inside the courtroom, and did Stevens address the court?
Well, this is the same courtroom where Stevens sat on trial day after day last fall. It's where a jury declared him guilty and where probably some of his worst moments in life have occurred. But today, it was a very different picture. He stood before the court, not as a defendant, but sort of on his own terms, facing the judge. And he addressed the court in a way reminiscent of his role in the Senate, with a booming, confident voice. It was a contrast to how he looked, which was honestly a bit tired and weary. But he was forceful when he said thank you to the judge, his own lawyers, and the new prosecution team that's been uncovering evidence in the case. He also thanked his loyal friends and staffers and Alaskans and said wherever he's gone in the state, people say, I'm praying for you, Ted. Stevens said today's proceedings have restored his faith in the justice system, but he did say that the prosecutors who botched the case will never really know the consequences to him and that the damage can never be reversed. After the judge ruled that the guilty verdict would be thrown out, Stevens went to his family, and his daughters were crying. It was very emotional, and Stevens made the rounds giving hugs and shaking hands. He even went over to the Justice Department table and shook the hand of the new lead prosecutor, who's trying to straighten out the problems at the Justice Department. You know, the former senator had 13 lawyers there with him, which is, you know, a huge number of lawyers to be working on your case compared to the Justice Department's three. So his side of the house was pretty full of happy people.
What did Judge Emmett Sullivan say about the situation today? He's had ongoing concerns about prosecutors failing to turn over evidence and information.
Well, he said the case has had some shocking and disturbing moments and said in his nearly 25 years on the bench, he's always told defendants they'll receive a fair trial, but that didn't happen this time. Sullivan said he's never seen anything approaching the mishandling and misconduct in the case, and he rehashed all the instances of oversight or problems by prosecutors, some of which were blamed on mistakes or just inadvertent errors, and sometimes the prosecutor said the information wasn't relevant. But when you heard them stacked up one after the other, it was quite powerful. And the judge even quoted himself from an admonition he gave early in the trial when he said, justice shouldn't depend on a lucky day or having a really good lawyer or an FBI whistleblower. It should be done fairly and in accord with the Constitution, and the judge does not believe that happened here.
Judge Sullivan appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the government attorneys involved in the case. How significant is that?
It's very significant. This is highly unusual. The Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility is doing an internal investigation, but Sullivan says so far they've been mute on what they've found, and months have gone by since the first problem surfaced. So he wants a public reckoning, and he's asked an independent Washington attorney named Henry Schulke to investigate six prosecutors, Some are based in Washington, but some are also based in Anchorage.
So what happens from here?
Ted Stevens has said that this cloud that he refers to hanging over his head has been lifted. He did say in court today that he'd like to, once the dust clears, actually help change the laws to make sure future defendants don't have the same problems he does. He has a mountain of legal bills that he needs to deal with. Now, besides the special prosecutor who's looking into what happened at the Justice Department, there are some other loose ends to tie up. But the next big question is, what implications does this have for other investigations into the Alaska political corruption? These prosecutors who are now going to be investigated are at the center of that. And there are some people who are being investigated. We don't know how it will affect them. We did see Don Young's lawyer, Congressman Young's lawyer, sitting in the courtroom. He was in the press section, actually, watching the proceedings. So I'm sure he had an active interest into how this all goes.
All right, Libby, thank you for that update.
Thank you, Lori.
APRN's Washington correspondent, Libby Casey. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council has taken action to limit Chinook bycatch by the pollock fleet in the Bering Sea. In an attempt to increase Chinook returns to western Alaska rivers, the council unanimously voted to put in place a 60,000 fish cap with an incentive program that would aim for a limit of around 47,000 Chinook. Some in the pollock fleet worry the new rule is too strict. But fishermen in western Alaska say it won't do enough to increase Chinook returns to their rivers. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Denby Lloyd put forth the motion.
It's taken the council a while to get here, but this is a very substantive check on that uncontrolled bycatch.
The council believes that the policy balances the needs of the pollock fishery and the salmon fishery. Pollock boats that participate in incentive programs will get benefits if they keep their bycatch numbers under their individual portion of the 47,000 cap, but they'll have insurance in case they get a lightning strike or an accidental large amount of bycatch.
What do you do in the extraordinary event of what's been called a lightning strike here? And we provided for an opportunity for that to happen and not shut down the pollock fishery. In exchange for that, the pollock fishery has agreed to conditions where they are going to operate under incentive programs that in most other conditions are going to force their bycatch to well below the 47 or 48,000 cap. Perhaps, if the calculations are correct, down to a level at 32,000. And we believe that incentive aspect of this program is extremely important.
Boats that opt out of the incentive plans only get their individual portion of a 28,000 fish cap. If the fleet as a whole exceeds the 47,000 limit for any 3 of 7 years, then the 47,000 limit becomes a hard cap. Lloyd thinks the plan as a whole is a good compromise.
Pressure's on. The pollock fleet obviously provides a lot of revenue, a lot of jobs, but hopefully there's a wake-up call here that they need to be responsible for their externalities, for the costs that they're imposing on other people, other groups.
Other non-voting council members disagree. State Department Representative Nicole Ritchie told the council that she thinks the action is in direct violation of the requirements of the Pacific Salmon Treaty between the United States and Canada. Not enough Chinook are reaching Canada and the Yukon River to meet the treaty's escapement requirements. And Ritchie argues that this action does not do enough to help that problem. Ultimately, it will be up to the Secretary of State to determine if the action is in violation of the treaty. If it is, the action will be overturned. Ritchie also told the council that they're showing disrespect to the people of Alaska by allowing the desires of a fishery that is less than a quarter of a century old overrule the needs of a fishery that have sustained people for thousands of years. The people of the Yukon and from Norton Sound agree. Art Ivanoff from Unalakleet hasn't had a commercial salmon fishery in his region since 1998, and subsistence harvests are severely limited.
I think that the level is still too high. I just think we could take an approach that's a lot more conservative. I'm looking at my stocks and I'm saying I've only got 900 kings up my river system and the forecasts don't look any better for 2009. So it's not conservative by any means.
He and others are trying to devise a strategy to change the decision, which relied heavily on suggestions from the pollock industry. The industry developed the incentive programs and promoted them during the 1.5 days of public testimony. Paul McGregor with the At-Sea Processors Association called the hard cap limit a safety net and not what the fleet would actually shoot for. Captain Charles Bronson from the Great Pacific supported the policy, especially the insurance-like Salmon Savings Incentive Plan.
But the SIP is the one that would be, I feel, do the most for salmon reduction. You know, you keep a running record always. But in the shoreside sector, you need to be able to build that little bank account for that hiccup in there, or that lightning strike that, you know, you might end up encountering at some point down the road.
Before the new program is put into place in 2011, it requires final approval by the Secretary of Commerce. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers debate electric rate subsidies for rural residents.
The state ought to be encouraging people to look for alternatives and to certainly seek efficiencies.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaskans in the south central part of the state were jolted today by a 4.6 magnitude earthquake around noon. The earthquake was centered about 20 miles north of Anchorage. There were no reports of damage. It was a relatively shallow quake, only 15 miles deep. Natasha Rupert is a seismologist at the Alaska Earthquake Information Center in Fairbanks. She says earthquakes in Alaska can be 150 miles below the earth.
And because it was near the surface more, people over a much larger area felt it. If it was deeper, it probably would not be felt over such a large area.
The earthquake was felt as far away as Whittier, about 60 miles away. Rupert says the quake isn't anything out of the ordinary for South Central Alaska. Scientists at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration have issued a report card on the condition of the Arctic sea ice as its annual spring melt begins. It looks as if the sea ice is on track for another withdrawal similar to the last 3 years. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
When it reached its maximum on February 28th of this year, the Arctic sea ice covered 5.85 million square miles. That's the fifth lowest winter maximum on record, but more extensive than what it's been in recent years. Scientists were hoping to see more, but considerable ice drifted out of the Arctic Ocean over the winter. And chances are now slim that much of the ice that made it through the cold summer of last year will survive to thicken and become more resistant to climate warming. Alaskans will have little trouble remembering that last summer was far cooler than average, so last fall, Arctic ice did not melt back as far as it did in the startling pullback of 2007. Walt Meyer is with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado.
At the end of last summer, a lot of the first year ice survived the summer, which usually most of that melts.
Scientists were relieved and said it looked as if the pullback of the ice had hit a plateau for a while. Now the ice would thicken, becoming what they call two-year ice. And some of it did, but a lot of it got blown away instead, pushed by winter storms out of the Arctic Ocean. Scientists now have satellites sophisticated enough to tell how old ice is. An animated tracking they released yesterday shows that winter winds pushed a lot of older ice out of the Arctic Ocean and along the coast of Greenland to the Atlantic. This included 150,000 square miles of that year-old ice that survived the cool summer last year, and 73,000 square miles of ice older and thicker than that. The result is that we start the melting season right about where we were a couple of springs ago. So by this fall, the withdrawal is now predicted to once again get down to somewhere not that far above the record lows of the past few years.
I think unless we get another really warm summer that we melt a lot of ice, 2009 will probably be in the same ballpark as 2007 and 2008. But if we get a warm year, a warm summer, it's certainly the way the ice cover is set up this winter. It's set up that it could potentially go as low or lower than 2007.
2007 was a record. Meyer says it's not unusual to see that much ice leave the Arctic Ocean over the course of a winter. About 10% of it goes every winter.
Yeah, there's always winds blowing the ice around in the Arctic throughout the winter and through the summer, and there's always an export of ice out down south along the coast of Greenland. I would say that this year's not particularly remarkable.
But scientists have seen more and more of the older and thicker ice get blown out in recent years. At this point, only 10% of the ice on the Arctic Ocean is multi-year ice, as compared to the 30 or 40% that would have been normal a decade ago. The ice cover at maximum this winter was 70% just one-year-old ice, very prone to melting this summer. NASA's records do show that in Alaska waters, the Bering Sea was cooler than average this winter, and it still has more ice than usual. But all of that is first-year ice expected to melt away over the summer. And to the east, in the Canadian Arctic, any hope of a recovery of sea ice due to the survival of first-year ice last fall is just gone with the wind.
That replenishment is maybe a little bit helpful, but it's not a sign of any kind of long-term recovery or long-term replenishment of the thick ice, at least not yet.
The sea ice tracking data shows a long-term downward trend since 1980. NASA's Tom Wagner said at a news conference yesterday that the ice is now thinner than ever. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Palin administration wants to create a new state forest in southeast Alaska. The goal is to dedicate more logging land to support the region's mills. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
A pair of bills in the state legislature would designate about 25,000 acres of the region's woodlands for timber production. 20 parcels in the central and southern panhandle would become the new Southeast State Forest. The parcels are near Ketchikan, Wrangell, Thorn Bay, Whale Pass, Edna Bay, and the head of the Bradfield Canal. The land is already in state hands, and state foresters have the power to allow it to be logged, but it's not fully set aside for timber sales.
The impetus behind this bill is to make sure we have a long-term timber base and not just one that's available in the short term.
Marty Wellborn Freeman works for the Department of Natural Resources Forestry Division. She says some of the land has been logged and needs work to increase future harvests, but that won't happen if there's a possibility that it could be sold, which state forest designation would block.
In managing timber, we like to be able to go in and thin that timber 15 to 20 years after it's been harvested. That allows us to increase the productivity of the timber from that land. It also has benefits for habitat enhancement, and it means that you can get more timber off a smaller land base. But it's hard to make the investment that thinning requires unless you know that you're going to have that land available in the long term.
The 25,000 acres are available for hunting, recreation, and other uses. Wellborn Freeman says that will continue if they're designated as a state forest, but their prime use would be for timber sales. J.C. Conley chairs the Timber Committee of the Southeast Conference, an organization of the region's business and government leaders.
I think it's a good piece of legislation because it gives the State Department of Forestry the ability to manage these state lands that offer the ability to produce timber. It gives our state foresters more direct influence on how these lands are managed.
The state estimates the forest would provide up to 7 million board feet of timber a year. That's a small fraction of what the industry says it needs. But Southeast Conference Timber Coordinator George Woodbury says it's still of value.
Every little bit helps, and hopefully there'll be opportunities for adding more to this in the future. So every bit is critical at this point in time, so we're happy to see it happen.
The measures could avoid opposition from environmental groups. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council's Mark Gannott says it's taking a friendly look at the bills so far.
We're still talking to our members and different people in the communities that would be affected. But if it really truly helps to supply sustainable timber base for the small local mills that they would process here in Alaska, then we can support that.
The Southeast State Forest bills were introduced at the request of the Palin administration. House and Senate versions received a small number of committee assignments, which could allow them to move quickly. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Senate today approved permanent increases and changes to the Power Cost Equalization Program. Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman explained the PCE program.
PCE is an equalization, trying to address the equalization of power costs between rural and urban Alaska, but this does not make them equivalent.
PCE will subsidize the electric bills of rural residents when the kilowatt rates are above 12.8 cents per hour. The law permanently raises the PCE portion from a cap of 52 cents to $1. As an example, Hoffman pointed out that people in Lyme Village pay $1.12 a kilowatt. That means they'll end up paying around 25 cents. Anchorage residents pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour. The Republican minority rejected the bill. Anchorage's Con Bundy said the state might not be able to afford the higher level of help in the future.
The state ought to be encouraging people to look for alternatives and to certainly seek efficiencies and be conservative in their use of any energy source we have, particularly in areas where the cost of energy is high.
The bill is now in the House for consideration before the end of the session. Alaska's new U.S. Senator Mark Begich made his first address to the state legislature this morning, discussing his congressional agenda, but mostly he talked about the state's opportunities coming through the federal economic stimulus money. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Saying the U.S. economy is in the worst crisis since the Great Depression, Senator Mark Begich reminded legislators of the problems in the lower 48. High unemployment, increased bankruptcies, depressed housing markets.
Fortunately, we are sheltered from the worst of it here, but still Alaska is not immune to the national recession. Our state's unemployment rate reached 8% in February, the highest since 1992. And just last week, we were troubled to learn that more Alaskans lost their homes to foreclosures than any time since the oil price crash of the early 90s.
He said the stimulus is the number one focus of Congress and thanked the legislature for protecting the money to which the state is entitled. In a press conference following the speech, he said that Alaska is on track to receive $1.5 billion. And he said the talk about strings attached to that money is not justified.
As Alaska invests the benefits of the recovery bill to help stimulate our economy, we're pursuing numerous initiatives to keep our industries healthy and create more jobs for Alaskans. My philosophy has always been that government's role is to help create pro-business climate and then get out of the way so the private sector can do their job.
Begich recognized that there's concern about the dollar amount of the stimulus plan. Senate Minority Leader Jean Theriault wanted to know about the future cost of the federal actions and how the nation will pay its debt.
A number of people are just, they're fearful. They're fearful for what is happening to the nation. They're actually, since I've taken elected office, this is the first time I've had people actually express fear for the future of the country. A lot of that is tagged to the size of the deficits.
Begich says he hears that question a lot, but he hears more that the only way to get the economy moving in a positive direction is to stimulate it.
We've got to put some money on the table, and that's what we're doing. Do I like it? Not necessarily. Is it necessary? I believe it is, along with a couple other things. One is also you got to grow this economy.
Begich said more than building infrastructure and satisfying business that can make new investments, the big goal now is to develop confidence among the public. And he says he's beginning to see some small changes taking place. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
While politicians are using North Korea's rocket launch as reason for continued development of the missile defense system, not everybody is convinced. No Nukes North coordinator Stacy Fritz in Fairbanks says the system is far from proven capable of deflecting such an attack.
People in the administration are now finally admitting that the ground-based missile defense system that we have, besides being extremely expensive and well-known for cost overruns, it's never met any kind of its own testing. And there's a reason that they didn't actually deploy it, to try and counter this missile.
The multi-billion-dollar mid-course missile defense system has had mixed results in tests, and officials admit a hostile attack would likely include complex decoy measures that are difficult to simulate. Fritz says the threat of a North Korean missile attack is being overblown.
The media never makes it clear that North Korea is a long, long way from being able to launch a rocket that could carry a nuclear weapon. That is very different from a rocket that attempts to launch a satellite, which North Korea has not even been able to do to date.
Fritz says the best course of action with North Korea is to set an example by adhering to anti-arms proliferation treaties and exercising political pressure. Alaska's Public Health Department has a new state-of-the-art facility for detecting disease. The updated virology lab opened in Fairbanks in January. The lab conducts disease surveillance, testing specimens from around the state. As part of a series of interviews for National Public Health Awareness Week, we talked with the lab's manager, Terry Schmidt. He says the lab has a good reputation with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta.
And our geographic location means that occasionally we see things up here that may presage what might be seen in the lower 48. We have in the past sometimes submitted some of the very first, if not the first, influenza isolates of the season. We also see or have seen in the past summer influenza, circulation of influenza. There were some significant outbreaks on cruise ships and the tourist industry and a couple of summers back. So occasionally we see things that aren't so prevalent here.
What diseases that aren't in Alaska yet are you watching out for?
We had capability of doing West Nile virus surveillance, and we did that for a number of years, and we could do that, you know, fire that up again at any time it was needed. We had the capability of SARS detection when that was an issue. And we are currently have the capability to detect the H5N1 avian influenza virus.
Why is it important for Alaska to have its own lab here in the state?
One of the reasons is that as a laboratory, we can detect those viruses that are currently circulating in a time frame that's appropriate and disseminate that information. Part of the mission of public health is not only to do the testing, but to disseminate that information to public health officials. And so by having it in the virology testing in a central location, all the specimens come in here and we're able to see and track what circulates around the state.
Terry Schmidt manages the state's virology lab in Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.